This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Dead Man Walking.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to PTBN Rewind, the monthly showcase of some of the greatest wrestling cards of all time. Take a look back, take a look at the matches, the interviews, the music, the pageantry, the pomp, the circumstance, you know, anything we can. My name is Ben Morse. I'm the host of this show. We are coming at you semi-monthly again. We'll see how long that lasts. Fingers crossed. For today's show, I've got a great duo with me. They're inseparable. You got to book them together. That's just the way to go. And that is the hard-traveling fanboys. Nick Duke, you there?
Yes, sir. How's it going?
Good, man. Welcome to the show.
Appreciate it.
And, of course, we couldn't have you without Greg Phillips. Greg. Gregory.
Yes, sir. I am excited to be on to talk about another wrestling pay-per-view with you, Ben. It's been a while.
Been a little bit, but we had a good one this time around. We had a few thematic ties. I always try to do those thematic ties to the past when we do these. Last time we did Clash of the Champions, because there was a new WWE pay-per-view called Clash of Champions coming out. This is a double because it's No Mercy, which just took place for the SmackDown brand, and it's also main evented by a Hell in a Cell, and that's the next Raw pay-per-view, Hell in a Cell. So it's like brilliant synergy or something like that, something along those lines. So we're covering No Mercy 2002.
Yeah, it seems...
it seems only appropriate that we get to this. But, a lot to talk about with this. I'm going to get into the show in a little bit. First, let's get a little background on our panelists tonight. So, Nick, where were you in 2002 as far as being a wrestling fan? And being just a decent human being.
Oh, I was huge back into it. 2002 is often what I refer to as my wrestling rebirth. I mean, it was the return of Hulk Hogan earlier in the year, WrestleMania 18, rolling into Backlash, and that kind of brought me back in, and I've never really left since. Like, the 3 to 5 years preceding that, I kind of would come in and fade out and come in and fade out, but 2002 was the year that brought me back full-time, and I've never really left since then. So, you know, later in the year, I do know that I was having trouble. I don't believe we had UPN at the time. Mm. SmackDown was still on UPN, if I'm not mistaken. So I was having a little trouble following a lot of the SmackDown storylines, but I was still watching Raw, you know, religiously. So as we'll discuss, some of these SmackDown angles are a little bit of a dark spot for me. Like, I just didn't have much of a memory of them. So
they're a dark spot for a lot of people who saw them, too, so I wouldn't worry too much about that. Greg, let's swing over to you. What was your wrestling status in the fall of 2002?
Oh, I was as into it as ever. I was, you know, I lived for wrestling in those days, so I was just starting off college, actually. It was my first semester of college, and so I was so scared of the world that I was like, and unsure of myself, that I would just find any excuse to lock myself in my dorm and watch wrestling. So
I was way into that one.
Yep, that was my go-to. So unfortunately, I didn't watch the pay-per-views live because there was really no way for me to order them in the dorm. But I would watch the excellent Scramble Vision version of them, and then read the results online.
It's the Statute
wonderful
of
website such as 411
Wrestling. 411 Wrestling, classic. Used to have some great writers. Scramble Vision, the Statute of Limitations is up on that. We're cool with you saying that.
I think so. I haven't gotten any legal notices lately.
We'll find out.
Also, I haven't talked about it on a podcast lately. So
yeah, a lot of lawyers listen to this podcast. Very popular in the legal demographic. So we'll see what happens. I was in an interesting spot when the show came out. I was actually in England. Doing my semester abroad. It was my junior year of college. So when this show happened, I was over in Norwich, England, home of Paige, and I did not have access to really the TV or the pay-per-views. But what I did have access to was live events when the WWE came over. So a buddy of mine, we actually went and saw WWE live in Manchester. with the main event of Edge against Brock Lesnar. So that was pretty cool.
But oh, that's cool, yeah.
I would go down to the college I was at, East Anglia University, did have a pub, and they had about a million TVs, so I could usually get them to show wrestling on one. So I watched Raw, muted, with the sound off. I distinctly remember Batista coming in and squashing Justin Credible. That's, believe it or not, that's my most distinct memory from the fall of 2002.
So you were in England during the show. I think they referenced that they're getting ready for Resurrection coming up either a week after this or 2 weeks after this. Did you catch that UK-only show?
That's what I was at.
Oh, awesome.
That's the show I was at. Yeah, I went to the UK-only pay-per-view. It was great. It's good stuff. Matt Hardy against Booker T. A bunch of other matches. And it was, you know, it was a happening.
They were hanging from the rafters, right?
Literally hanging from the rafters.
But were they hanging and banging is the key question.
They were hanging, they were banging, they were clanging, they were doing it all. So let's get into the show, boys. Let's dive into the first match. Interesting array of talent here. We have SmackDown and Raw split rosters, much as we do today. And this was a combination show. This is before they went to brand exclusive shows. So this had all the guys from SmackDown, all the guys from Raw, mixing it up in one glorious Sunday. And it started with a match between Booker T and Goldust, who are a fairly popular team at this time, still chasing the World Tag Team titles, which earlier in the summer they had been chasing Lance Storm and Christian. Lance Storm and Christian lost the tag team titles to Kane and the Hurricane, of all combinations, and then Chris Jericho and Christian regain the title. So here we have Booker T and Goldust continuing their pursuit. And what you got here is an interesting state where you have a match with four guys who are all singles stars. But for whatever reason, I thought this really gelled as a tag match. It's about a 9-minute tag match. It ends up going the way of Jericho and Christian, and I have some questions about that. But first, Nick, talk to me. Let's start with Booker and Goldust. Why did Booker and Goldust, two guys who were known for their singles careers, even if Booker had been a tag team champion many times before, why did these guys click and why did the fans get into them?
From the standpoint of the fans, I can say for me personally, it was one of the rare instances of WWE comedy actually working. Like, Booker T and Goldust just had comedic timing and comedic chemistry, whether it was in the ring, in their backstage segments. I mean, pretty much everything they had done to that point in 2002, whether it was, you know, Goldust's obsession with joining the NWO or Goldust and Booker T at the movies, all that stuff just really, really worked. And so when you build guys organically like that and the audience has a connection to them outside the ring, that can translate to in the ring at times. And so I just kind of thought that's what was going on at that point. Also, Goldust, you know, he was in pretty good shape. You know, he came back in 2002 and it didn't last very long, but he had a pretty good little run that year.
Greg, flipping over to the other side of the ledger, you got Chris Jericho and Christian. Chris Jericho still every bit kind of the main event run. He'd just come off an Intercontinental title run. He was a threat for the world title. He'd been undisputed champ earlier in the year. Christian's still finding his sea legs, still a bit of a tag guy. But where do you see this team gelling? Were they a good choice to be the standard bearers of the tag division at this point in time?
You know, I remember at the time, you know, I was a huge Jericho fan, Jericho-holic, if you will, from the WCW days. So I was, thank you. I appreciate that.
No problem, man. Anytime.
I was, I was kind of frustrated with where Jericho was in the company at this time. It really felt like he was a main event threat, but it felt like he had been de-emphasized in favor of course, Triple H as the top heel on Raw. And then, even some of the other characters on Raw had been getting a lot more elevation, even Ric Flair actually getting more of a singles presence than Jericho. And so it was kind of frustrating as a Jericho fan, but I thought his alliance with Christian kind of, it worked because they both got how to be heels and how to antagonize against a hot babyface act. And it felt like Booker T and Goldust as well were really hot at this time. So I think it was a good idea to program Jericho and Christian together to work with them, get good matches out of them. We'll get to that in a minute, I'm sure, but I'm not sure that I would have made them a long-term tag team champion presence, although, you know, it worked out fine, but it seems to me that this might have been the time to put the titles on Booker and Goldust.
Well, let's throw that out there. I mean, Booker and Goldust had their first shot in August at SummerSlam. A lot of people thought they were going to win the belts there. They were, as you guys mentioned, red hot as babyfaces. And, yeah, this was kind of the second on-pay-per-view choke for them. They would get the titles later in the year, but they'd barely hold them. Both of you guys talked to me about the decision to not put the titles on Booker T and Goldust here. Would you have made the same one? Did it work out fine? Or do you think there was one more to benefit from them getting the straps here?
I think it was, to me, the time to do it. I mean, you can't have a team lose multiple times in a prominent situation like that if they're going to be a, you know, a long-term team.
Mm-hmm. Right. The interesting thing about Booker and Goldust is it seemed like they were a long-term team until they succeeded, and then it was time for to go their separate ways. It was almost immediately after they won the belts, they ended up going their separate ways, and Booker T was on to bigger and better.
Nick, let's
get your take on it too.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, I think in the commentary they make reference to the fact that you know, Christian and Jericho had just won the titles 6 days before on Raw, so mm-hmm. I can somewhat understand the idea to, you know, to put the titles, to keep the titles on them, to keep, you know, get a little heel heat, to build them up for the eventual, you know, Booker T and Goldust win. So I can kind of see both sides of it. I mean, like you said, Booker T and Goldust were so hot at the time that, you know, you kind of wanted them to see them go over there. But at the same time, you know, 6 day title reign probably wouldn't have done Jericho and Christian any favors either.
Mm-hmm. As far as the match itself, what did you think, Greg? Was it a solid match? I mean, what you had here is four guys who are singles competitors, but also all happen to be, I would say Jericho is probably the least tag team specialist of the bunch. I mean, Booker T, Goldust, a lot of tag runs in WCW, Christian, of course, with Edge. You think they meshed on a pretty good match? I felt like just the babyface heel dynamic alone really carried the match.
So I'll answer for Greg since he had to take a little break there. I really liked the match. I mean, what's most impressive to me, I mean, not to blow past the meat of the match or anything, but how well Jericho was able to call an audible with the finish, because mm-hmm. Jericho at one point goes for a lion salt and the middle rope just completely breaks off.
Right.
There's a piece of the rope that kind of goes flying, and don't really know like what happened there, or, you know, if it was a mistake by the ring crew or if it just was a shoddy rope to begin with. I don't know, but Jericho making the audible, swapping to the top rope moonsault for the finish instead of going for the lion salt, just kind of worked. I mean, he was able to practically save the match, which is impressive in my opinion. You know, but other than that, I mean, I thought the match worked really well. I thought Christian and Jericho showed some chemistry, especially for a team that had only been together for a short time, and of course Booker T and Goldust were just, they were awesome at, you know, selling and drawing the heat. So I mean, I thought it was, for a 9-minute, you know, opening pay-per-view match, this is about as good as you can expect, I think.
Yeah, I mean, when I saw the rope break this time, because I didn't remember it from previous watchings, when I saw the rope break, I didn't know what they were going to do. And to Jericho's credit, much differently than many other guys, he doesn't throw mid-ring temper tantrums. He doesn't get upset. He just goes on to the next move. It was similar to, it reminded me of all things to when Neville got injured earlier this year, and he was trying to do the slide into the ring on Jericho, and Jericho managed to somehow, even after Neville, like, broke his leg, walk him through something of a match, at least get the segment over. So,
Yeah, great improvisation from Jericho there, and you know, they really worked their way around a bad situation that could have been a lot worse, and mm-hmm. just four pros who knew what to do in that situation. So, good work. Cool.
All right, so the champs retain, and we move on to the next match, which for those of you, like you said, if you didn't have UPN, you were basically just dropped into a bizarro landscape where Funaki is a backstage interviewer speaking to an old man who is Tori Wilson's dad about his ongoing love affair with Dawn Marie, another one of the divas. We get clips of him fully clothed in the shower with Dawn Marie, Tori being shocked,
making a Twin Peaks reference in 2002.
Oh yeah, big Twin Peaks reference.
Funaki calling out Al Wilson for being in the shower clothed.
Yes. Funaki was ruthless as a backstage interviewer. He pulled no punches. He certainly, you know, asked all the hard questions. I want to analyze this storyline because this storyline's always fascinated me. Just for this simple reason, what is Dawn Marie's motivation? Like, what does she accomplish from seducing this old man? Is Tori really? It's one thing to steal someone's boyfriend or fiance or whatever, because then you're really affecting them. But she's basically just macking on Tori's dad, who, you know, presumably Tori could be like, oh, I'm so happy he's with, you know, another woman who makes him happy. It didn't add up for me. Greg, explain this storyline to me.
Well, help me clear something up in my mind. Was it established at any point, does Al Wilson have a lot of money or something?
That was never established. That would have made it much clearer.
Well, if there's not, then my only assumption can be that at some point in the backstage area, Tori Wilson wronged Dawn Marie in some way. Mm-hmm. And Dawn decided, hey, I have to get revenge on Tori the only way I know how, and that is to seduce someone close to her. Well, she learned that Tori has a very close relationship with her father and resents the fact that her father is trying to move on from her deceased mother character.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
So Dawn moves in and says, hey, the best way to get back at the evil Tori Wilson, who I don't like, is to seduce her old man, maybe even kill him by sexing him to death. And then
I love that was a thought. That was a thought that she had. Maybe I can.
I feel like that was a conscious move on her part, which really, who can blame Tori for getting upset?
Oh, yeah, no. Tori's totally justified. I'm wrapping my head around the Dawn Marie bit. I mean, we know, those of us who watched know that where this eventually goes is two places. Number one, Dawn Marie seduces Tori into a night of passion down the line, basically as a, I'll leave your dad alone if you'll get with me. So that's a whole other layer. But then, yeah, she does, as Greg explained, she does eventually do in Mr. Wilson via coitus. coitus deadliest, we would call it.
Kind of like a Xenia on a top from GoldenEye, if you remember that character.
Yes. Oh, yeah. That was Famke Janssen's character, right?
Absolutely. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, it was her and Dawn Marie had a lot in common. I'm sure. When did that come out? The late 90s?
95. 94. 95, 96, somewhere in there. Maybe 94, like Greg said.
So Vince was probably getting around to it around 2002.
Yeah, that and Twin Peaks he was getting around to it.
Yeah, Twin Peaks.
And the fact that Ray Combs was dead.
Yeah, he had just watched Twin Peaks. He was pissed about the fact that they had it on cliffhanger. So he decided to do it here. Nick, talk to me about the actual match between Dawn and Tori. Is it worth watching at all?
No.
Do they have any chemistry together, or is it just a waste?
It's a waste. I fell asleep. Yeah. I'll be honest. Last night, this was I split it up into two different viewings, and like, you know, I was laughing, you know, during the pre-match Al Wilson interview and kind of you know, the little clips they used to introduce the feud and stuff. When the match started, it was just, you know, it was just typical of what some of the worst divas work could be at the time, you know, and it's really sad because, you know, there were some good workers in the division back then. I mean, later on we get a pretty decent Trish and Victoria match, but this one just did not work for whatever reason. But mercifully, you know, based on my memory of it, again, like I said, I fell asleep. It was pretty short, so not too much, you know, pain that the audience is subjected to there.
I will say there's something to be said for both Al Wilson and Funaki, two guys, neither of whom seems to speak English as their first language, doing an interview segment together, and it's pretty entertaining.
Yeah, Funaki, I thought, was the star of the entire segment. He was. I had forgotten him being that good in that role. I really had.
Yeah, he was phenomenal. I would bring him back today.
Me too. He'd be so much better than the generic, nameless interviewers they have backstage now.
Number one SmackDown announcer Funaki has always been a favorite of mine, and will continue to be.
And I'll say, I'll be a little bit of the voice of dissent. I won't say that the match was good or even decent, but it was a little bit better than I was expecting it to be.
It was like, fine. They didn't screw anything up.
Yeah, they didn't. Right. They didn't mess anything up. They, you know, they actually applied some holds here and there. They, you know, they made contact. So,
in all honesty, it was a fine match. It just wasn't a standout, and it just had a weird angle around it, so I think kind of bad. I mean, that's just my That's my hot take, is that it's really not that bad a match. It's just it's an average match.
Yeah, yeah, I would agree with that, especially for the lay of the land as it was at that time. It was about as good as you could expect from the division, at least right, that side of the division.
Well, let's not linger on the Wilson family drama too much. That's just it's not where we want to stay. Let's instead move on to a match between two heavy hitters, two big stars coming up, this their first meeting ever, and that's Ric Flair and Rob Van Dam. But before we get to that, RVD has a promo backstage, which could be qualified. It could be a good example of maybe why Rob wasn't given the world strap around this time. Greg, why don't you break it down for us a little bit?
Well, we get RVD in his natural element, which of course is cutting promos backstage.
I thought you meant stoned.
Well, that too.
Probably that.
Yeah.
It certainly appears that he had perhaps partaken of some substance, probably legal,
yep.
Before this promo, and he proceeds to cut a promo about how, you know, he also has, you know, some things in common with Ric Flair in terms of catchphrases, but that he doesn't share Ric Flair's love of things like styling and profiling and limousine riding and jet flying.
And he shows stuff. He shows it.
He struts back and forth, and he delivers what I certainly hope was a scripted promo to explain how it was so bad doesn't do any of these things. And then he lets loose with what has to be, let's face it, the worst woos of all time.
Oh, they're bad.
Just woos that sound as if Shawn Michaels was wooing, you know, like with that deep guttural
voice.
The raspy voice, yeah.
Just a bizarre promo and a bizarre attempt to make RVD something that he is not and never will be, which is a charismatic promo showman. He can cut promos. He can't cut promos like that.
No, and it's weird looking at WWE that they put him in that position, because this is a guy who has always, will always, seemingly forever, be a huge pop just based on his work in the ring, based on his charisma, based on all the intangibles. You never need to put him in front of a microphone to sell a match. You just say that Rob Van Dam's going to be in the match. Would you agree, Nick?
I would mostly agree, yeah. He was always better at cutting promos, based on what I've seen during his ECW run, than he was, you know, in WWE. And I think he's talked about that in interviews, how he always felt like the way he was asked to portray his character on WWE TV was not exactly, you know, an extension of who he is in real life. It was just basically a distillation down to a guy who says dude and whatever a lot. So, you know, there were some issues with that, with RVD's portrayal at this point in time. But I will say that, like, in terms of the feud, I was actually really into this one big time, because I remember the month before, RVD was like a revelation to me when I got back into wrestling. I thought he was awesome, and I was really hoping he was going to take the title off Triple H the month before. And so they totally got me with the Ric Flair swerve, and I was very much looking forward to this match just to see RVD get his comeuppance. But, you know, that being said, the promo, like Craig said, wasn't anything to write home about.
It was so interesting at this time, because you had the concept for so long when there was a distinct WWF, WCW and ECW of dream matches of what if this guy could wrestle this guy. And once WWE bought everyone, it kind of became the type of thing where they would notice they had a spare dream match sitting on the shelf and just pull it out as a mid-card pay-per-view match. Like, this is Ric Flair, arguably the greatest NWA WCW performer of all time. Rob Van Dam, one of the key faces of ECW. Certainly not the first dream match you think of, but would you guys qualify this as a match between two legendary stars that you really want to see? We'll go to Greg first.
You know, it's interesting, because when you put it like that, yes, because they're both legends in their respective brands. I think from my standpoint, it's like it would never cross my mind, because they're so drastically different style-wise. It would never cross my mind that RVD could wrestle Ric Flair. But I think when you look at the lay of the land at that time, it probably is one of the last, I guess you would say, dream matches or matches between two guys that were stars in different companies that you never thought would wrestle. I don't think that it's necessarily a dream match, but I think that you can say that it's a match between two legends and two different promotions, so that's pretty cool.
Yeah, interesting way of putting it. It almost makes you wonder, though, if they had done this in 2001 or 2000, when RVD was really the undisputed biggest star in ECW, as opposed to just another WWE mid-carder, if it would have been bigger. Nick, do you think it would have been bigger if it had happened in 2001, or do you think Flair Van Damme is always kind of a weird matchup?
It very easily could have been bigger. I mean, like you said, he was the biggest star in ECW at that time. I know for me at the time, like, I didn't really have much exposure to ECW. You know, it was kind of hard to find around where we were, especially the golden age of ECW anyway. I mean, we had the TNN show, but, you know, that was about it. And so for me, I think it probably, this match at stature probably has raised more in terms of the profile of both guys retroactively, because after you learn more about RVD through the network or his place in wrestling history, then it did strike me at the time. Like, because at the time I was like, oh man, I'm a big RVD fan, but I don't really know a lot of his ECW work. And obviously, you know who Ric Flair is. Everybody knows who Ric Flair is. So I was excited for the match, but I don't know that I would qualify it as a dream match for me at that point, even though I can easily see how it could be, you know, looking back on it now.
Now, when you have two different styles like these guys have, two drastically different in-ring styles, you know, Flair, old school as can be, chops, working the figure four, RVD flying all over the place, he's, you know, kind of one of the prototypical spot monkeys, it can lead to one of two things. It can lead to an awesome intersection between the two styles, or it can lead to something of a disaster. Which do you think we got here, Nick?
I would lean more towards something that was pretty good. I don't think it was a disaster by any means. I thought, you know, Flair working on RVD's leg makes sense because so much of his offense was built around, you know, the kicks and the springboards and stuff. So I like that aspect of it. But at the same time, I guess even for this era, which I know in 02 you're not getting Flair at his best, but I think I still expected just a little bit more, especially in hindsight, than what we wound up getting.
Greg, your assessment of the match?
Yeah, I thought it was actually pretty good. Like, I was surprised because, like you said, it's two of the most drastic style differences that you can imagine in a match. I mean, it just doesn't seem like it would work. But I thought they did a pretty good job of working around Flair's limitations at that point. And there was the sad spot where he couldn't do the flip over the corner.
Oh yeah, yeah.
A recurring problem for him. But overall, the match I thought was good. They worked it solid. They hit each other hard. It made logical sense, the story of the match and everything. Pretty much the only issue, you know, I thought it was just a solid match. But the only issue was, if you notice, when RVD pinned Flair, his shoulder was off the mat the entire time.
Yep.
And the referee just continued to count. But
do you think Flair being unable to do the Flair flip is basically the equivalent of an older man just not being able to achieve an erection?
Yes. Unfortunately, I don't know if there's medication that can solve the lack of Flair flip.
I know. I mean, I'm sure Flair's taking the other medication, so you would hope it would translate over.
So if Flair's having trouble, getting an erection, does that make it Flair floppage?
Oh.
Well, Ben, if you remember, he did take the other medicine because he used it right before he got into bed with Kimberly Page on Nitro.
Oh, sure. I remember that. Yeah, back in the golden days of Nitro in 1999. Excellent. All right, we get another little backstage vignette, this time with Big Show complaining about not being in the main events. Interestingly enough, this would be kind of a tipping point for Big Show because he had fallen about as far as he could in the company. He was, you know, losing to Jeff Hardy, and then he jumped to SmackDown, had a main event program with Brock Lesnar, and he's essentially been a main event star ever since. What do you guys think about that?
I thought he showed some good fire in the backstage segment. You know, something that I know in recent years he kind of struggled to do because we swing so wildly between crying Big Show and smiling, laughing Big Show over the last few years.
Right.
So it was cool to see a more intense side of his character that we don't often get to see these days.
Yeah, this was a huge turning point for him because it's easy to forget just what a laughing stock Big Show had become as a character by this point in his career. I mean, he had gone from an instant main eventer when he came over in 99 to a mid-carder at best, a guy that would come out in the opening hour of Raw and, you know, have a meaningless match and often lose to guys a quarter of his size with ease. you know, take finishers from guys that you'd never see get finishers on him now, you know, just not having a stellar career at that point. And this start that kind of momentum towards him going to SmackDown, where Paul Heyman, let's be honest, deserves a lot of credit for working with him and turning his entire viewpoint on things around, making him into a monster again, which he had not been for quite some time.
And to his credit, he rises to the occasion. I mean, he is definitely inspired by and coached by Heyman, but you see it in this promo here, him starting to get a little bit of that monster back. And in hindsight, looking back on it now, it didn't seem like such a big deal. But like you guys said, when you put it in the context of what he was at the time, it was very weird to see Big Show in a, you know, big deal, significant backstage segment like that, and just talking crap to the two general managers. So definitely.
And Bischoff was so great at playing that smug GM character.
Yeah, he was one of the best. All right, so we transition over to SmackDown and the Cruiserweight division. Interesting storyline here where Jamie Noble is the champion. Nydia is his ring rat, and they're, you know, buying a double wide. I thought these guys were probably one of the most underrated acts of SmackDown history. They were
totally
so
agree.
All in on the gimmick. Nydia in particular, I thought, just for someone who was just a tough enough winner, she may have been one of the early most successful tough enough winners, just as far as someone who got the business and just did what she had to do. So watching the recap on this, there was some sort of boyfriend versus girlfriend match. Tajiri was the referee because Tajiri was buddies with Noble, and Tajiri took it in the direction that Noble and Nydia didn't like, so they ended up turning on him. Tajiri's the babyface again here, and we get a nice little match, a nice little title defense for Jamie Noble. I'll ask you guys, where did you think the health of the Cruiserweight division was here? Because it's interesting to look back any time from when WWE purchased WCW on to when the title died to where was the Cruiserweight title at now? Was it a decent division? Greg, we'll start with you.
Yeah, I thought it was awesome at this point, to be honest with you. This was my favorite era of the WWE Cruiserweight division, which isn't saying a whole lot, I know, but my favorite era of the WWE Cruiserweight division would have been from like 2002 maybe to 2004. Like, you figure the division at this point, you had Noble and Tajiri, you had Rey Mysterio, who was going to move down pretty soon and start having matches there. You had Matt Hardy, who would do stuff. You had London and Kendrick would come along, London in particular. Billy Kidman still around, having awesome matches. The Hurricane was around. So you had all these defined characters, colorful characters that would go out and have awesome Cruiserweight matches. And like you mentioned, Noble was a perfect champion at this time because that gimmick, Noble and Nydia, it was over. It was entertaining. He was having awesome matches, and they were just perpetually entertaining every time they came on screen. And I think that's important to have when you're trying to kickstart a division and trying to maintain the momentum of the division, is you have to have defined characters, and you have to give people a reason to invest and to watch the matches and then realize, hey, these guys are really good. And they had that in Noble, and they had that in Tajiri as well, who was already an established act by this point.
Yeah, Nick, let's flip over to your side of the ledger for Tajiri. How important was having the legitimacy that Tajiri brought to the Cruiserweight division here? How much did that make this match feel like a more important history-based match?
Oh, absolutely. It was extremely vital. I mean, Tajiri just always brought an intensity to all of his matches that, you know, few guys in the company could replicate. I'm always taken aback whenever I go back and watch a Tajiri match, especially from this era of WWE, and I'm taken aback by how much I enjoy it. Tajiri's not a guy I would ever consider to be one of my 5 or 10 favorite wrestlers of all time, but yet every time I watch one of his matches back, I love the hell out of it. There's just something about the guy. I don't know if it's, you know, his striking style or this innate charisma he has, but Tajiri is a guy who seemingly almost always delivered in every situation he was put in. So I actually really, really enjoyed this match, you know, taking a fresh look at it here recently. It was, you know, they had a good athletic showcase for both guys, and those strikes from Tajiri, those kicks, man, they still look vicious to this day.
Yeah, and then Noble will take them.
Yeah, he would. I mean, that's what people forget is that, you know, Jamie Noble was one of the first ROH champions. Noble was a guy who could legitimately go with anybody in the world, and I think people who are only WWE fans might forget that because of, you know, the redneck gimmick or the deal with Nitti or whatever. But there was a time when Jamie Noble was probably one of the 5 to 10 best workers on the face of the planet.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, yeah, that does him a good service. So Noble hangs on to his cruiserweight title, and we move on to, well, we were going to get here eventually covering this show, so we might as well dive into it. Triple H, world champion, defending against Kane, intercontinental champion. They've done kind of a nice job throughout the show of building it up as title versus title. This is the last time we're going to see the intercontinental championship, because whoever wins is going to absorb it into the world title. Really, it was almost like they tried to course correct a little bit on this show and make it more about the belts and about the athletic contest. But then we get the pre-match package, and we are right back into the midst of perhaps the most infamous storyline in the history of WWE, that being the Katie Vick, Kane, murder, molestation,
necrophilia.
Necrophilia free-for-all. I want to start from a different angle. We will come back to this, I promise. I would not have you guys on the No Mercy 2002 podcast and not let you talk about Katie Vick. But I want to, as best we can, extricate ourselves from the storyline, extricate ourselves from Jerry Lawler's ridiculous commentary, and just look at this as a pure
match. He's a murderer, JR!
Looking at this as a pure match between two main event superstars, guys who were experienced, guys who knew what they were doing, and my question to both of you is, all the bells and whistles aside, all the disgusting, rancid bells and whistles aside, is this a good match? Did they have a good match despite it all? Nick, what do you think?
It's okay. I mean, I can't really give it, you know, a ringing endorsement, but I will say that it is better than I remember it being, because I remember it being pretty terrible. But watching it back, I mean, that's one thing that you always forget, especially when you've watched so much modern wrestling, is that the crowds were into pretty much everything, even still back in 2002, even though they had, you know, died off a little bit from the Attitude Era. But so Kane was really, really over at this point. And anytime you have a crowd who is super into something, it always makes the match seem a little bit better than it actually is. And so the crowd heat was good. Then you had Flair come out, and Flair just bumping all over the place for Kane. That's one thing Flair could still do at this point, was it was ragdoll around with the best of them. So,
oh, my God. I saw him a couple months later at the Royal Rumble where Triple H defended against Scott Steiner.
Yeah.
And it looked like he had been shot when Scott Steiner punched him in the chest. It was brilliant.
Exactly.
The man's a genius.
Absolutely. So that was, you know, that added to the match. I can't sit here and say it was a technical classic, obviously, because it involves Kane. But as a pro wrestling presentation, man, I enjoyed it. You know, solid, you know, B to B plus, I would say.
Greg, how about you?
I enjoyed it less than that. Like, I think I watched it. I was tired when I watched it, but like, I cannot imagine a less interesting match, even in 2002, than Kane versus Triple H, because they're both wrestlers that have never really excited me. Triple H has had runs here and there. But, like, I will say this. Kane was super over at that time. He had come back. He was, you know, he had a lot of momentum. Triple H was very good at playing a heel, always has been. I don't know, man. I feel like it's a weird complaint to have, but I feel like Triple H was carrying around too much body mass at that time. If you
that's fair.
Catch my drift. He was he was a little bloated at that time, and it was really affecting. He couldn't bump around the way that he was doing maybe a year or two prior.
Right.
And so it was a little bit of a, I don't know. It was kind of, also, Flair was awesome in this match, as Nick pointed out, but it felt like they overdid it. Like, they kept going to that well. They had Flair interfere like 3 different times, and at a certain point, it almost felt like overkill. But that being said, it wasn't terrible. It wasn't an awful match. They did okay. I just, you know, it's kind of a bummer, too, because Kane was another red-hot babyface that kind of got absorbed into the Triple H reign at that time.
Yeah, I mean, the philosophy there was Triple H continually saying, I got to get stronger so I can put somebody over without the intention of ever really putting anyone over. And guys like Rob Van Dam and Kane paid the price for it.
Yep.
I thought this was an okay match. I'm with you guys. It wasn't an all-time classic, but it definitely got me entertained. I was impressed that they didn't, you know, Triple H showed remarkable restraint, not screaming, and this is for your dead girlfriend or something like that, as he is wont to do sometime. Lawler was doing it for him.
Oh, yeah, no doubt. Totally.
But let's talk about it. Let's talk about the angle. What? Who do you think they were trying to appeal to, Greg, when they were doing the angle? Which, of course, is that Triple H discovers that Kane was driving a car with a girl named Katie Vick. Car crashed. Katie Vick was killed. And then in a really kind of absurd leveling up of it, Triple H claimed that Kane... Sorry, guys. I'm back.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry about that. Phone call came in. Yeah, where were we? We were talking about Triple H accused Kane of being a necrophiliac, of trying to have sex with this girl after he had killed her. Who was this storyline for, Nick? Was it for you?
No, that's what I was about to say. I wanted to make this point. You know, I was 15... I was about to turn 15, so I was 14, about to turn 15 at the time. This should have been, like, if it was written for anybody, I feel like a 14-year-old is probably who it was written for.
But really?
Like, I don't know. That's the thing, because I had a friend that I would watch Raw with every week. I'd go over to his house, we'd hang out, we'd watch Raw. And so I vividly remember us both just sitting there and staring at the television when they did the Triple H dressed as Kane in the casket segment, you know?
The classic.
I was just staring at the television going, what in the hell is going on? Like... Even at the time, to a 14-year-old, it was one of the more bizarre, nonsensical things I had ever seen. Like, I can't even say that I actively hated it at the time. I had no clue what to make of it. I had never seen them attempt something quite as disgusting as this, even in the depths of the Attitude Era. So it was out of left field for sure. I have no idea who this was for, and, you know... You almost feel like they, like you said, they were trying to distance themselves from it a little bit with the, with the video package about the history of the Intercontinental title and building it up as, you know, more of a winner take all scenario. But then when they, right before the match, go back to it and you just hear the name Katie Vick repeated over and over for a 2-minute video package, it just drives home the fact this was a bizarre, bizarre storyline. It makes me wonder. Who in the hell came up with this? Because Vince Russo was gone by this point. You seemingly would have Russo's fingerprints all over it.
No, this is too far. This is a step beyond even Russo. I don't know who came up with this storyline. I don't know who it was for. I have like some minor inkling that it might have been It was WWE, especially Raw, around this time going like full soap opera.
Yeah.
Seeing if they couldn't attract, as bizarre as this is going to sound, some of the female demographic, because it sounds ridiculous, but the whole story.
Do you remember how popular the show Passions was at that time?
Yeah.
I don't know if you guys remember that. That show was incredibly popular, and they were famous for doing, you know, witchcraft storylines and bizarre, I mean, just outlandish supernatural stuff. So maybe you're right. Maybe that was the attempt to attract a more soap opera friendly audience, a female audience, something like that. But I think that the problem is they probably had males trying to come up with ways to attract females to the product,
right.
And it did not work.
I feel like it's at some point it started out as a more soap opera storyline, and then once the wrestling guys got a hold of it, once the Vinces and the Triple H of the world got a hold of it, it took a horrible turn. Because the thing is, the Triple H going to the morgue and dressing up as Kane and trying to have sex with Katie Vick, that feels like a Vince thing.
It really does.
A thing that like Vince would be entertained by and not understand why no one else is.
Yeah, and it was really weird too, because from a character standpoint, Triple H had been billing himself for months as this ultra serious, basically the Ric Flair world champion, you know.
Right.
He won the title, he was doing the suit gimmick, he was, you know, being the limousine riding guy, you know, he was being ultra serious and still a badass and all that stuff. And then he's going and he's dressing up as Kane and acting like 1998 Triple H again. So that didn't make any sense. And then you've got Kane, who's this big monster that people love because he's a big monster and he's cutting fun promos and all this stuff. And then he's like turning into crying Big Show, essentially.
Yeah.
It really hurt his character as well. And you could argue that Kane never really recovered from it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Kane was at one of the high points of his career here. He was in the best shape of his career. He was cutting promos, which is not something he had done in his formative years. He was doing a great job. The fans were getting behind him. And much like RVD, as you guys outlined the month before, he fell to Triple H, and RVD ended up in the mid-card after that. I would say RVD never fully recovered from that. Saying Kane had never fully recovered from that, let me posit this to you guys. Say Kane does go over here. Kane becomes the world champion. What do you do? I mean, do a little imaginary booking here. How do you see a Raw with Kane as a world champion looking? Who's he fighting? How much longevity does he have? How long could his stay on top work? So did Triple H really screw this one up? Nick?
It's kind of hard to say. I guess I'm rare in that I've never really viewed Kane as being on that level, even when the company has. So it's difficult for me to even sit here in fantasy book. You know, the problem was Triple H had gotten himself over to such a degree to the detriment of everybody else that there weren't many viable top-level heels for a babyface challenger to come in there and take on other than Triple H. I mean, maybe Chris Jericho, but like we discussed earlier, he was kind of tied up in the tag scene. I guess you could probably heat up Ric Flair for a short-term storyline, but even then, you get the idea that if it had been Flair, the whole thing would have been built around Triple H anyway. So, right. You know, I feel like even if they had put the title on Kane here, it probably would have been a short-term thing. It would have been a thing where you do it for a couple months, Triple H wins it back, you know, go heading into the Rumble so that you can heat him back up for whatever he's going to do at WrestleMania. So, you know, kind of hard to say what kind of situation they would have found themselves in with a babyface champion at the time.
What do you think, Greg? How would you salvage a Kane world title run? Can you salvage one?
I think it would have been good, and it would have helped a little bit for his legitimacy in the future. I do agree that it would have to be short-term because there were no heel challengers at that point on Raw. I mean, it would have been, you know, you get a short-term feud with Chris Jericho, but Triple H would have had to win it back by the Rumble. And unlike RVD, I don't know that Kane is a character that would really have legs as the world champion. He seems a little bit more limited in terms of how you can market him and things like that. And it feels like he's more valuable as the big monster you can have come in after taking a couple weeks off or something and really wreck shop on people. So maybe I would say maybe a 2-3 month title reign could have done a little bit for his viability in the future as a main event challenger or potential title winner at a later time. But I think the nature of the Kane gimmick makes it hard to imagine him with a long-term world title reign, if that makes sense.
No, it does make sense. I think the interesting thing is that our knee-jerk reaction, even 15 years later, is to remember that Triple H buried all these guys and destroyed all these careers in 2002. But with that wealth of knowledge behind us and being able to look at it a little more pragmatically, it does make sense for Triple H to go over in a lot of these cases. It just, by hook or by crook, it just doesn't make sense to have RVD or Kane or any of these guys as world champion for a lot of the reasons you guys are listening. Lack of heel competitors, not strong viability, lack of mic work. So it's just an interesting way to look back on it, and I think, you know, this is one of the more significant aspects of the show, so I think it's well worth delving into a little bit.
May I posit a fan theory real quick?
Of course.
Is it possible that Kane indirectly created or allowed to become what would later become Raven's Flock in WCW? And let me, to quote the great philosopher JR, let me tell you why. My fan theory is that Katie Vick is related to Scott Vick.
Well, that was always, he was always rumored to be brought in as her brother.
Yeah, and so, yes, and so my theory was when Kane allegedly caused Miss Vick to be killed in this tragic car accident, it scarred her brother forever. It hurt him psychologically, and it led him down the path to becoming Sick Boy. And Sick Boy, as anyone can remember, was one of the key founding members of Raven's Flock in WCW. And who knows if Raven's Flock would have ever been able to capture the United States title from DDP to run roughshod over the lower mid-card of WCW had it not been for Kane murdering Katie Vick all those years ago.
I'll tell you something. It's a theory. It's something to go on. And I think it's what we're going to go through our break on. Because we really need some time to think about that and digest it. You are listening to PTBM Rewind. I'm Ben Morse. I'm here with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Steve Duke and Greg Phillips. We're talking about No Mercy 2002, and we'll be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Voice of Ring of Honor's Kevin Kelly here. I just want to make sure you're all subscribed to all of our great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. Now, it's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search for and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation Wrestling Feed, Place to Be Nation Pop Feed, Pro Wrestling Only Feed, and, of course, the Kevin Kelly Show Feed, which includes the full archives of my podcast. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And, of course, as always, enjoy all the great action of Ring of Honor Wrestling and everything presented to you on PlaceToBeNation.com.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com, and we offer them to you across two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast with our famous vintage wall pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with the smash hit Clotheslines and Headlines, our steady veteran main event, and the beloved monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on all pro wrestling super shows. Relive wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the always contentious Dangerous Alliance podcast, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. On our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, NBA Team, Lucha Undead, Geek and Sassy, and a veritable podcast heaven for comic fans with Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both of those feeds on iTunes and rate and leave feedback for us as well. All of these shows plus others available at PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks via the links on the right-hand side of our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The PWO PTBN feed has changed its name. Now it will be known simply as Pro Wrestling Only, so it should be easier to find and indeed to say. All of your favorite shows are still here, including Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, This Week in Wrestling, and many, many more, including our full archives of tremendous content. So make sure you subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only feed today.
Guys, welcome back to PTBN Rewind. My name is Ben Morse. I'm joined by Nick Duke and Greg Phillips, the Hard Traveling Fanboys, and we are breaking down No Mercy 2002. You can watch it on WWE Network if you have it. Go find your old DVD or VHS. There's plenty of good ways to watch No Mercy 2002. And we're into the shank of the evening now. We've just gotten past the Triple H Kane match, and now we go to the in-ring highlight, for sure, of this show, and kind of the crown jewel of the show, and that is Edge and Rey Mysterio taking on Chris Benoit and Kurt Angle for the vacant WWE tag team titles. The story here is that Stephanie McMahon has created tag team titles exclusive to SmackDown because the WWF or WWE World Tag Team titles are on Raw. There's a tournament. Edge and Rey Mysterio emerge as one of the top teams. Los Guerreros emerge as a top team. And Chris Benoit and Kurt Angle, who had been rivals and who had been wrestling each other, who had a great match at Unforgiven 2002, Stephanie forces them to be teammates with the idea that if either of them does not try their hardest, they will be suspended for a year. Before we get into all the great stuff that this produced and the excellent match tonight, what did you guys think of that storyline of putting Benoit and Angle together? Because, of course, the tag team partners who hate each other's storyline is a tried and true one, but this had a little bit of a twist on it with what Stephanie did. Greg, how well did you think this worked out logically, and how well did it hold up?
I loved it. I mean, to be honest, I thought it was really clever. I didn't remember this, to be honest, the suspension storyline. You know, it may seem a little extreme, maybe unrealistic to have it be a year unpaid suspension, but yeah. But I did like it. I thought it added some stakes to it, and it took away a little bit of the cliched, well, they're just going to – one of them's going to intentionally cost the other the match kind of deal. And honestly, it made it more interesting than something like the Sheamus and Cesaro storyline that's going on right now. It actually, to me, it made a lot more sense because it gave you a reason why they would work together and actually try to help each other win the match instead of spend the whole time trying to one-up each other, which we've seen a billion times in wrestling. So for me, it was really effective and kind of added some stakes to the match and added some a reason why these two hated rivals would actually help each other out and do double-team moves and stuff like that.
I'll throw this out there mostly for Jordan Duncan, and I'll direct it to you, Nick, because you would be remiss if we didn't address it. Does Stephanie look too powerful here? Does she just come off as, oh, all right, well, I'm going to cut the balls off both you guys. You have to team up. You have to do whatever I say. And I'm going to suspend one of you for a year, even though that would probably be terrible for my brand. Is Stephanie too powerful here?
Well, yeah. I mean, but that's her every time she gets in a position of authority on air. I mean, like... That is a, like you said, the wacky tag partners who hate each other is kind of a well-worn trope of the wrestling genre. You know, Stephanie McMahon overexerting her power is equally a well-worn trope. Mm. So, I mean, it's just, you kind of have to expect it with Steph here. You know, that being said, you know, it did, like you said, it added a little something. It added some motivation for both guys to actually work together rather than just... doing the typical thing of one screws over the other in the end, and you come out with one as the clear heel and one as the clear baby face. So, you know, I wound up liking her involvement for what it's worth.
So these guys they comprised 2/3 of what was called the SmackDown Six. The other two being Eddie and Chavo, Los Guerreros. And basically, Paul Heyman was booking SmackDown at this time. He would take any combination of these six guys, whether it was a six-man, whether it was a tag team, whether it was a one-on-one, and they would just go out and fill episodes of SmackDown with great wrestling every week. Was this the pinnacle, this match of the SmackDown Six? Were there better matches before or after? Greg, what did you think? And, you know, use this as a way to kind of talk about this match and what you thought about it.
Yeah, I don't know. There were a lot of great matches between all these guys around this time. I mean, I remember a triple threat with Rey versus Angle versus Benoit that was incredible on SmackDown. I remember a Fatal 4-Way number one contenders match with Edge, Benoit, Angle, and Rey that was incredible. But I have to say, this is the first time I've watched this match in, God, probably at least 10 years, easily. Mm-hmm. And it's remarkable. It to me, I would safely say this is the pinnacle of the SmackDown Six. I can't think of a single thing wrong with it. I think every single, and when you consider the complexity of some of the spots they were doing, everything was hit perfectly. Everything was hit with precision. Everybody was in the right place at the right time. The timing was perfect. I mean, to me, this was just four of the best wrestlers in the world at that time. All of them at their physical peak. Edge wasn't at his peak as a character yet, but I do think this was his peak as an in-ring kind of athletic worker. And Ray, of course, was still phenomenal. Angle was the best, probably. Benoit was right there with him. And they just, they went out there and they busted their asses and they put on one of the best tag team title matches I've probably ever seen on pay-per-view. I mean, it was incredible and an easy five-star match, in my opinion.
One of the things I loved about the match, and there's a lot to love about it, was the way Benoit and Angle interacted. They did not interact as, like, there wasn't the cliched shoving spot or them not getting along. It was once they got in on this, they determined to win it. You know, Angle was patting Benoit on the back. Benoit was tagging to Angle. It was all very fluid, and it was all very – it became a sub-storyline of, all right, Edge and Rey Mysterio are the baby faces. How can they possibly take down this impossibly good team of guys, the super team of guys who have been put together? And I thought that was a nice little sub-storyline for the whole thing. What did you think of the match, Nick, and what did you think of its place in the SmackDown 6 era pantheon?
Well, unfortunately, like I said, not having UPN at the time, I missed a large portion of the SmackDown 6 era. So I can't speak on it, you know, from an overwhelmingly informed historical perspective. But I can say that, you know, going back and watching this morning, just a few hours before we recorded this, I was blown away. Like, I remember it being great. I watched the pay-per-view live when it aired, but I did not remember it being this great. I mean, you talked about the interaction between Benoit and Angle, and that was great to be sure, but I just love the innovativeness of Edge and Mysterio's offense. The way that they would, Edge, who's not typically a power wrestler, would toss Mysterio into tag team spots, particularly the spot where Angle's sitting on the top rope and Edge tosses Mysterio up over his head, and he goes right into a Hurricane Rana off the top on Angle. Just amazing tag team wrestling in a way that, you know, Edge had always been a great tag team guy with Christian, but you had never seen him bust out some of the innovative spots like he did here. This was just, like Greg said, everything they did was so complex, but they didn't miss a beat on hardly anything. And then I loved the distinction between the two teams. You have Edge and Mysterio who are there with kind of the more flashy moveset, but then you have Benoit and Angle who it looks like are legitimately killing the baby faces in the ring. I mean, those Angle locks that Angle snaps on at the end are just brutal, brutal submission moves, and I loved that finish, how Angle just kept going back to the ankle lock and Edge couldn't get out of it. But I'm a sucker for the ankle lock. It's always been one of my favorite finishes in all of wrestling, so...
Did it surprise you that he didn't have to go to the unbreakable leg lace ankle lock?
Oh, the grapevine.
Just used the normal one.
Yeah,
he didn't use the grapevine.
Had he debuted the grapevine at this point? Because I'm kind of fuzzy on when that came in.
Yeah.
I want to say used it in one of the Benoit matches before
that.
Yeah,
I thought so too.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Sure. But no, the sub-storyline also of just how the bully nature, the way that Benoit and Angle almost played bullies in this match, where they were just playing around with Ray and throwing him around and using their size and all of that stuff, and then how they did some really clever spots where Ray turned it around on Angle and got the little, you know, the paintbrush spot on him, and Edge and Ray really started pouring on the offense and made Benoit and Angle dig deep and have to overcome it, even to the degree that Edge, his own, like, cockiness cost him because he tried to beat Kurt with his own finish. Remember putting him in the ankle lock, and then Kurt, of course, knew the counter, put him in the ultra-vicious ankle lock, and then that was all he could take. But just incredible work from these four guys, and a nonstop pace. And not to criticize the current roster, because I love the current roster, and they do great work, but a little thing that made this match, I think, even greater to me and stand out is there wasn't any of the standing around waiting that you get in modern matches because of the complexities of the spots. These guys were instinctively in the right position at the right time. They didn't have to wait. They didn't have to pause. It didn't look overly choreographed. It was a great match.
And to piggyback off what you said about the bully aspect of their characters, Greg, they got that over with the backstage segment before the match, where it's pretty much just Benoit and Angle screwing with Los Guerreros for the sake of screwing with them, just because they can. So, you know, that was a nice touch there as well.
Yep.
I think a nice compliment needs to be paid to Rey in particular in this match, just because, you know, Rey Mysterio is a guy who he's physically limited in what he can do, which sounds ridiculous to say about Rey Mysterio, but in terms of when he's in there with three guys who are bigger than him, which he will almost always be in there with guys that are bigger than him. He can't slam anyone. He can't suplex anyone. He can't powerbomb anyone. All he has is his incredible array of aerial maneuvers. But to go in a, you know, 20-plus minute match and hang with three guys who are two times your size, I think that deserves some special consideration. I think Ray is, you know, not an unsung hero of this match, because everyone in this match is revered, but he had a little more to work with, a little less to work with than everyone else, and he still made himself a vital part of the match.
Absolutely, and I think that a lot of people forget, too, how good Ray still was when he came over, because Ray has always been a great wrestler. He still is. He just had to change his style significantly his last few years in WWE, but at this point, he could still do almost all the things that he could do at his peak in the late 90s, but he also was adapting very quickly to the WWE style and knew where to be and knew how to play off of these guys who, you know, for most of Ray's WCW tenure, he worked with guys who were, you know, maybe a little bit bigger than him, but similar in stature. And here he is working with bigger guys, but bigger guys that could work. Bigger guys that could go and that could make his offense look as good as it should look. And, yeah, he was outstanding here and really throughout this entire era and going on into the next year even when they put him in the Cruiserweight division. He just continued to deliver week in and week out.
What did you guys think about the long-term viability of Angle and Benoit as champions here? Do you think you knew the belts were going to be hot potatoed pretty quickly as they were? They went to Edge and Ray pretty quickly after this. Or do you think these guys were going to have a long reign as tag team champions, Greg?
Watching at the time, I think they were my two favorite wrestlers in the world at that point. So I was hoping for a long-term reign. But in my mind, I kind of figured that they would drop the belt not too far away. I thought they'd hold them until the December pay-per-view and then drop them, and then they'd do a split storyline and they'd feud, you know, going out of there, maybe into the Rumble. But I kind of figured it was going to be switched back and forth between these three teams. I knew that the Guerreros would eventually get him, and I figured Edge and Ray would get a good run too. So, I think it was always going to be a short-term kind of fix when you've got two main event type wrestlers in a team together. I just was hoping that it would last maybe a little bit longer than it did, but I, you know, obviously it all worked out fine, but it was, at that time, maybe my hopes were not realistic. So
you can dare to dream, my friend. Well, that was a spectacular match. It's, I do not envy anyone who has to follow that match. And in this case, it is the women's championship. Trish Stratus putting the belt on the line against Victoria. Interesting matchup. It's their first one on pay-per-view. Trish kind of at an interesting place here in terms of her evolution as a worker. Not the all-time great she would be known as yet, but starting to make some waves as, you know, not just eye candy. What did you think, Nick, of Trish at this point? Where was she as far as her evolution?
Like you said, she was well on her way. I mean, my first introduction to her, or I guess the first thing that I vividly remember her doing was the storyline where she was seducing Bubba Ray Dudley for whatever reason. but at this point, she had kind of...
Because why not?
Yeah, because why not? Who wouldn't want to seduce Bubba Ray Dudley?
Right.
But like you said, I mean, she had really come a long way since then. I mean, she wasn't a fully formed version of what she would become, but I would argue here in this match, she shows you that she can go. I mean, she shows you a level of athleticism and a level of coordination that escaped a lot of the women at the time and a lot of the women since. I mean, Trish, you could make the argument, picked it up faster than just about anybody we've seen in the women's division, which is kind of impressive. I, for one, really enjoyed this match. It's short, it's to the point, but it's two girls who are in there and mostly know what they're doing. So I like this one.
Greg, talk to me a little bit about Victoria, who kind of gets forgotten when talking about the golden age of the women's division. You know, we hear a lot more about Trish, Lita, even Molly Holly, Jazz. Victoria gets glossed over a little bit, but she was certainly a key cog. And did she come in right out as an impressive competitor?
Oh, absolutely. And but before that, I also wanted to say that I myself, you know, I can relate to Trish. I just seduced Bubba Ray Dudley the other day.
Yeah, so, no, it happens.
It does. It, you know, you can't really...
You don't even realize you're doing it until you're done.
No, it's like it happens, and you're like, wow, I didn't even know that was a thing, but all right, cool.
Yeah, there you go.
But, you know, Victoria was really good, no doubt. And what she did was when she came in, if you notice, she's much bigger than the other women. Like, she's taller, she's physically stronger than the other women in the division at that time. And so she served as a really strong base for a lot of these girls to work off of, particularly for someone like Trish, who was still evolving as a worker at that point. It was so good to have somebody that could, you know, that could whip her around in some of these tilt-a-whirls and hold her up for big backbreakers and really help her continue to improve her selling while she was working on her offensive side. And what you saw in this match was Victoria really controlling with power moves and throwing Trish around and controlling the pace of the match. And I think that Victoria's athleticism and her natural physical strength brought an element to the women's division at that time that was completely absent. You know, she wasn't going to come in and do hair pulls. She wasn't going to come in and do, you know, the traditional diva spots. She was going out there and she was hitting hard, and it was forcing Trish to hit back. In some ways, I would liken it to, you know, obviously Sting was much more progressed than Trish by that point, but in some ways, this was Trish's Vader. Victoria was Trish's Vader, who went in and hit her hard and made her have to dig down and find a more physical offense to combat it, basically.
Nick, how much of a, maybe if not an FU, at least kind of a insult was it to these girls to put them on after the tag match and before the main event, which, you know, was certainly the popcorn spot? And how much did they do to rise above being put in that position?
You know, I hesitate to say it was a big FU, but it's certainly unfortunate. I mean, based on my memory of it, this was probably done because it was the one that had the least amount of angle, the least amount of storyline behind it. It was more of kind of a straight-up traditional, just, you know, in-ring competition storyline rather than one of the wacky, you know, I'm seducing your father or whatever storyline.
I guess that's what I'm pointing towards. Like, they could have put that here.
And probably should have.
They could have reversed the order, so that's where I'm saying it was a little bit of an insult.
And I would agree with that. You know, it easily could have been moved around and shuffled around because probably if they go earlier in the show, they probably get more time and they're probably allowed to do more from a match layout and a match structure standpoint, because I get the impression here, while I enjoyed the match, like I said, I enjoyed it more than I remembered enjoying it, I kind of get the impression they were told to keep it mostly simple to the point, not to get the crowd too tired out before the big main event, because the crowd had just gotten so into the tag title match that preceded it. So I kind of feel like they were forced. Their hands were kind of tied in terms of what they were allowed to do out there.
Good. All right. Well, it's a nice 5-minute match. Trish goes over. We head into our main event of the evening, which is Undertaker, Brock Lesnar, Hell in a Cell. They have a great video package setting it up. I want to talk a little bit before we get into the match about the angle surrounding things. There was an amusing thing we didn't talk about at the very beginning of the show where Kane basically sits down next to Undertaker in a locker room and goes, so how was your week? Because they've both had terrible weeks storyline-wise. And Undertaker's is, I didn't even fully understand this, and it was hard because I, you know, wasn't going to go back and watch old SmackDowns to get it. But I guess an old flame of Undertaker's comes in at the behest of Paul Heyman and basically says that she wants him back. Puts a restraining order on him, which, of course, is the last thing you do if you want to win somebody back. But just alleges that, you know, she's been with Taker, tries to screw up Taker's marriage to Sarah Undertaker, who was pregnant with a baby at this time. A lot of stuff going on. Great. Did you understand what was going on here? Can you do a better job of explaining it than I did?
Well, you kind of poked a huge hole in the motivation of the Tracy character there.
Yeah.
Because, like, the original storyline, as I recall it, was Heyman was just trying to play mind games with The Undertaker. So he brings in this woman who claims to have had a relationship in the past with Mark Undertaker. And and she, you know, she says that, but not only in the past, she's claiming that within the last 30 days they've had an affair. And this is a problem because The Undertaker, his wife is pregnant, and so now his wife doesn't trust him because she thinks that he's having an affair with this Tracy lady. Well, okay, all that's well and good, but like you said, we find out at No Mercy that Tracy's end goal was to get Mark back on her side. Mm-hmm. And if that was the end goal, then why get a restraining order and why try to ruin his life in the process. But just sort of a strange, really strange element that I didn't remember until they showed the package. And really wasn't needed for this feud at all.
Yeah. That's the crazy thing. I mean, you look at Katie Vick and all that stuff, and that was kind of like, well, it's a Kane Triple H feud. I guess it's okay if they wanted to try something. It's not like Kane and Triple H were going to have a classic feud on their own. Here, we've got Lesnar and Undertaker, and that's all you need. You've got this great built-in storyline of Lesnar being the new dominant force on the block, Undertaker being the older guy who thinks he has one last shot left in him, the title's on the line, they are inside Hell in a Cell because they had a match at Unforgiven where they just brutalized each other to the point where there was no decision, and you need Hell in a Cell here. We complain all the time now that there's a Hell in a Cell pay-per-view that they'll just throw matches in Hell in a Cell that have no business in Hell in a Cell. Undertaker-Lesnar was the perfect match to put in Hell in a Cell. It wasn't really so much about keeping people out as it was about keeping these guys contained so they could have a winner. And, you know, they go on, we'll talk about it in a sec, they go on to have a great match. It's very odd that they felt they needed to stick a soap opera-esque storyline. We haven't even talked about the fact that at one point Lesnar confronts Sarah Undertaker backstage and, like, puts his hand on her stomach because she's pregnant and just, you know, maybe like gives some sort of Brock essence in there. It's a whole mess. But yeah, if ever a match did not need this kind of soap opera, I would think, Nick, that you would agree that this match did not need this.
Oh, it absolutely didn't need it. And I didn't even remember it, to be honest. Like I said,
yeah,
you know, not having UPN at the time, yeah, and just kind of watching the pay-per-views, what stood out to me back then was the match. And so I guess in the years since, I had kind of just forgotten the entire angle. And so when I revisited it, I was kind of sitting there laughing going, you know, what the hell is this? And who is this terrible actress they've hired to portray this Tracy character? Because that backstage vignette with Steph is one of the worst, most painfully awkward things I think on this entire show, which is saying something.
Yeah.
It's pretty awful, especially Steph's Triple H inspired leather jacket look that she's rocking.
Well, Steph comes off as, you know, the biggest baby face in the company again in that segment.
Always.
Just being able to easily come out on top. Yeah, it was just, oh man, it was so weird because the Triple H and Kane match, as we said, you know, it was fine. But the Undertaker-Lesnar match is just, in my opinion, one of, if not the greatest Hell in the Cell matches of all time. We'll talk about it again in a sec. And, you know, to their credit, Taz and Michael Cole do not do the Jerry Lawler of, you know, Jerry Lawler bringing up Katie Vick the whole time, basically distracting JR from calling the match, basically not allowing Jim Ross to call the wrestling match. Cole and Taz, on the different wavelength, just totally focus on the physicality in the ring. Do not talk about what's going on with Undertaker. They have another element of Undertaker where he's got a broken hand.
Yeah.
He's got this cast he can use as a weapon, which you'd think would be enough additional stuff there. But let's talk about the announce teams for a sec, contrasting the announce teams. Greg, who do you think did a better job of kind of juggling storyline and action in terms of all this?
I definitely would have to be honest, I'd have to say Michael Cole and Taz, which kind of surprises me because I love the JR and King tandem, particularly JR and his reaction to King shenanigans. Now they did have some pretty funny moments on there with they're in the middle of one of the random men's matches. Lawler starts talking about the Brock and Undertaker angle, and he's like, JR, do you find pregnant chicks attractive? And JR responds with a classic, what in the hell does that have to do with anything, for God's sake? And so that was a great moment. But overall, I mean, Cole and Taz were really in a zone right now. I mean, Cole has never been as good as he was during this stretch of SmackDown. And, you know, I thought they did a really good job. There were a few moments here and there where Taz sometimes does that thing where he gets a little bit too cute in the middle of a match where he messes up a word, then he makes a couple jokes out of it, and it kind of slows the thing down. But overall, it was a really good performance by the SmackDown crew, and I thought Jerry had a pretty rough night on this one.
Absolutely.
He did not do a good job of sucking me into any of the matches.
Yeah. let's talk about where this match ranks in the pantheon of Hell in a Cell matches. I used to do a column for a place to be nation called the Five Count, where we would rank different things. And one of the things we ranked was Hell in a Cell matches. And if I recall correctly, I think this, if it didn't finish on top, it was definitely right near the top. And I rank this as one of the best Hell in a Cell matches of all time. I think it's a great mix of gore with, you know, plenty of bleeding and plenty of brutality, but also just great technical work on the inside from Brock. These two had a believable rivalry where you thought they really wanted to hurt each other. They used the cell without just resorting to one spot making the match. I hold this very high in regard as a Hell in a Cell match. Where do you rank it, Nick?
I'd have to agree. It'd probably be definitely my top five, probably in my top three, or maybe even challenging for that top spot. I'd have to really go back and look at some of the other ones. But like you said, the big thing is with the cell matches, too many of them rely on that big, huge bump, and this one doesn't have one of the bumps off the cell or through the top of the cell or whatever. And yet, the brutality of the moves and the brutality of, you know, some of the weapon stuff they do here makes up for it more than enough. In particular, the spot where they have Lesnar and Heyman have tied Taker's hand to the cell, and Lesnar is just beating the hell out of the cast with the steel chair, even to the point that the leather belt even breaks from the steel chair shots. I thought that was one of the coolest, most innovative Hell in a Cell spots I've seen. It especially stood out on this rewatch. You know, you would never see something like that today, because I think a lot of guys just don't think of stuff like that nowadays.
Mm-hmm. Greg, where would you put this in your Hell in a Cell ranking?
Off the top of my head, I would definitely put this in the top three. I would strongly consider it for the top spot. I mean, the first Hell in a Cell is great.
Yeah.
And it's revered with Shawn and Taker, but this one, I don't know. I'm itching to kind of give this the top spot, maybe because it's fresh in my mind. But like Nick said, the brutality of this one is just out of this world. It's easily the most convincingly brutal of all the Hell in a Cell matches.
They earn it.
Absolutely. Yeah, the story of the match is great. With they work the Undertaker's broken hand into the match tremendously. They have him kind of overcoming the pain. They did that spot the backstage segment before the match where the Undertaker gets a shot.
Yeah,
and it explains why he can use the cast offensively even when he's being. Even when it's being beaten on by Brock, and these two just brutalize each other, and they had great chemistry, the kind of chemistry you wouldn't expect for two big guys like this, but they really just from Jump Street, they get in there, and they're laying into each other, they're not holding back anything, it's brutal. Even the manager Blades outside the match, which was a cool touch, as Heyman is outside the entire time screaming and screaming and screaming and being as obnoxious as he can possibly be, and Taker's, you know, just bringing it to Brock. But the thing that I wanted to focus on this match was just how amazing Brock Lesnar's bumping is for a guy of his size.
Right.
I've never seen it. I've watched wrestling for 30 years now, and I have never seen any human being his size or bigger that makes it look as effortless as Brock Lesnar does, and or at least did at that time. I mean, some of the height that he got on some of these bumps when he was getting thrown into the cell by Taker, the just animalistic way that he throws the stairs across the ring, I mean, just incredible. And then the height he gets on the choke slam, the height he gets on the last ride, the way that when the Undertaker boots him or punches him or throws him into the cage, he flies off like a cruiserweight. Just incredible, and it made you get across. It got across the fact that the Undertaker is a dangerous man, that he's a threat to the title, and that he's a guy fighting for everything that he's got, and he's going to put the champion through hell. Just an incredible match, and I would firmly put it in the top two. I would say top two Hell in a Cell matches of all time, along with the first one.
You talked about how Lesnar bumped so incredibly for a big man. The other thing for me is what a ring general Lesnar is and how composed Lesnar is across the ring from a legend in this highly dangerous gimmick match, and he's less than a year into his WWE career. The fact of what a prodigy this guy was, what did you think of that, Nick?
Oh, I mean, it's incredible. I mean, Brock Lesnar, Kurt Angle, those are the two guys in all of WWE history, I would say, who picked it up the fastest and went from basically rookies to legitimate main eventers and legitimately guys who could be counted on to go out there and not just put on a great performance, but lead a great performance, call it in the ring. Now, granted, Brock Lesnar's in there with a guy like The Undertaker who has been around the block and clearly doesn't need any help from a guy like Brock Lesnar, but...
Sure.
You know, Lesnar at that point, I think, had already proven that he could do his part. He could carry guys if he needed to. And this match just shows a new side of Brock Lesnar. This is like to go back to it. This is the most brutal form of Brock Lesnar we had seen to this point. I mean, those you know, whether like Greg said, the animalistic tossing of the stair steps, to go back to the chair shots with the leather belt and everything, but also, you know, some of the blade jobs in this match, my Lord, they cut each other open, or they cut, you know, themselves open with just some absolute gushers that were, you know, Ric Flair and Shawn Michaels-esque at times. I mean, those things were pouring. Even like Greg said, Paul Heyman has to be given, you know, a gold star for being willing to take some of the punishment he did in this match. And I'll throw out one aspect of his performance that I loved is as Brock is laying into Taker with the chair, Heyman is screaming histrionically, "You're gonna die. Now you're gonna die. Now you're gonna die." Which is over the top, sure, but it adds something to it, man. Brock and Heyman together, that whole presentation is today and has always been just a wonderful pairing that bring out the best in each other.
Well, fellas, that is the card, but let's get final thoughts on the overall card. If you want to put a bow on this Lesnar-Taker match, if you want to talk about something you didn't get a chance to earlier on, let's get to that because we are kind of wrapping things up here. Greg, let's start with you, man. Overall impressions of the show and any points you wanted to make before we head out.
Yeah, I mean, this is a show that's kind of taken on a little bit of a reputation since it's aired, and I see why, because this is a show that you have a pretty wide swath of things. You have bad angles, granted. You have some historically bad angles even on this show, but you also have really hard work from the women, really good cruiserweight match, and then you have, of course, the two linchpin matches, the two SmackDown main event matches, which in their own completely different styles, but both great classic matches that'll be remembered or should be remembered for years to come. So this was really a show that is the definition of, if you just put aside the storylines for a minute and you just put great wrestlers out there to wrestle each other, great things can happen. And this was a case where that happened. And it also had one of the most memorable endings to a pay-per-view from the Ruthless Aggression era, which is Brock Lesnar standing on top of the Hell in a Cell with both his and The Undertaker's blood covering his body as he holds the title up in the air. A classic ending shot of a pay-per-view.
Iconic. And,
iconic. And probably the most iconic still shot of Brock Lesnar's career, maybe only surpassed by him standing in the aisle after ending the streak now. But a great show that I would recommend to any wrestling fan who either hasn't seen it or hasn't seen it for a while, because I don't know about Nick, but for me, it was really an eye-opening type show to go back and watch just how good the work was on this show.
And I want to get to Nick in a sec, but I want to piggyback off a point you made, Greg, talking about contrasting kind of the rough angles to the great matches. This was a time where Raw and SmackDown were probably more distinct than any other time during their history. This was when SmackDown was purely the athletic show where the great matches were coming from the SmackDown 6, from Brock Lesnar, from the Cruiserweights, and Raw was very much, you know, Triple H's soap opera, some other things go on. This and as much as probably the three of us are going to sit here and praise the SmackDown portion of the show, there were people who preferred Raw because they preferred storylines and they came into wrestling for over-the-top characters. But this was just a time when Raw and SmackDown were about as different as they could be, and it probably as close to replicating the WCW-WWF rivalry, just as far as having two distinct brands, as they were going to get. So I just want to say that piece. And now, Nick, let's get your final thoughts.
You know, one of the things that stood out to me, I think, is just how remarkably consistent this show was. Even the perceived low points, whether it's, you know, Torrey and Dawn Marie or Triple H and Kane, there was nothing unwatchable. There was nothing egregiously bad on this show. So pretty right. much from the time you turn it on until the time, you know, 3 hours later it wraps up, you're constantly entertained. Especially in hindsight, because rather than being frustrated and disgusted by stuff like Katie Vick or Al Wilson, you kind of find it comical now to just kind of shake your head at what the writers were coming up with back then. So especially as a presentation here in 2016, man, I really, really enjoyed this. I thought it was one of the more consistent pay-per-views I've seen. I would definitely recommend it to anybody who hasn't seen it in a while or not seen it at all to go back and check this out, because, you know, like kind of like you were saying earlier, Ben, if for nothing else, it's a great representation of what that era of the SmackDown 6 was all about, in potentially the pinnacle of that era with the tag title match.
Absolutely. So, guys, there's a another great pay-per-view for you guys out there to watch. No Mercy 2002. Like we said, you can watch it on WWE Network. Not that we're shilling for them, but hey, you know, why not? It gives a pretty good service. I want to thank my guests, Nick Duke and Greg Phillips, the Hard Traveling Fanboys, for coming on. Boys, tell them about where, when, how often we can hear your wonderful podcast, which I have been lucky enough to be a part of here on Place to Be Nation.
Which you will be lucky enough to be a part of here on PlayStation.
Well, I mean, I've been part of the recording. And
that's right. That's right. You have yet to make your debut.
Yes, I will be part of the airing soon enough.
In true comics parlance, part two of this two part crossover will be airing later on in November as Ben joins us to count down our top five Marvel video games of all times. But we are weekly. Mm-hmm. We try to drop. Typically, we shoot for Thursdays, but sometimes that slides into Friday or Saturday, depending on the production schedule. But we are weekly, and, you know, we try to hit there, you know, later in the week, each and every week. And, you know, Greg, why don't you tell the people about some of our recent shows?
Well, we have the month of October has been dedicated to The Walking Dead. We've done we have our recurring features, Countdown, where we do lists every month. And our Countdown this month was the top five Walking Dead characters. We had Jennifer Smith join us for that from the Geek and Sassy podcast. We did we have a feature called The Long Book Hunters that's a monthly show where we look at a trade paperback collection. And in this case, we looked at the first collected volume of The Walking Dead comic. We also, you know, we've looked at, gosh, what else have we looked at, Nick? The first episode, the pilot episode of The Walking Dead as part of Off the Page, where we view comic book items from other media outside of the books themselves. And then we have a very special episode that you can listen to where we will be reviewing the season premiere of The Walking Dead television show. And, of course, we have a recurring Marvel Cinematic Universe series where we look at the MCU movie by movie. This is called Hard Travelers for Hire, and we've got we're going movie by movie, starting at the beginning. We started with Iron Man. We're moving on to The Incredible Hulk with Russell Sellers joining us, and we'll be doing a different Marvel movie every month. So that's what you can expect from the Hard Traveling Fanboys.
Great stuff, great listens. I recommend everybody makes the Hard Traveling Fanboys a regular stop on your podcast tour. And we appreciate you making PTBN Rewind a stop on your podcast tour. We'll be back hopefully next month with some Thanksgiving goodness in November. And again, I thank Greg Phillips and Nick Duke for joining me. This has been Morse reminding you to be kind. Rewind. We'll see you again soon.
you play it, it's all about control. And if you can take it, it's all about your debt. And if you can pay it, it's all about the pain. Who's gonna make it? I am the game. You don't wanna play me. I am control. There's no way you can shake me. I am your debt, and you know you can't pay me. I am your pain, and I know you can't take me. Play the game, you're gonna be the same. You're gonna change your name, you're gonna die in flames.